Standing near a babbling pond filled with orange and white fish, Cody Hogan is looking out over his plush backyard 16 years ago, and it's grown a lot over that time.
Right, these are young...
And it's grown a lot over that time.
Right, these are young Brussels sprouts. These are an Italian onion variety that I've never grown before, and I've actually forgotten the name of. You can see some different kinds of kale. And then we have more chives than anyone would ever possibly use, even with a restaurant, but they're so pretty in the spring that it's nice to have those.
But this, he says, is the decorative section of the garden.
This is the more almost utilitarian rows of vegetables. These are a few different kinds of cabbages. I have turnips. I have a few beets coming up. These are the snow peas that have been ravaged by either squirrels or a rabbit that I can't find. And then always useful herbs like sage.
He was going for a mix of business and pleasure, growing some things to look at and some things to eat.
This is the last of the spinach coming through here. More potatoes over here, some shallots, borage. That's kind of an uncommon vegetable. You can eat the flowers. They're beautiful little flowers that taste like cucumber. Or the leaves when they're really young, you can make a soup out of. Delicious.
And one more thing. Yep, there's an active beehive.
But this last year we had, out of this one hive, we got about 8 gallons of honey. It's it's a lot of fun, and they're really amazing and productive and relaxing to watch.
This legendary garden has been a source of inspiration between Cody's shifts as chef de cuisine at Lydia's. Now he's leaving the kitchen to become the general manager at the restaurant. That's an unusual path to take, but Cody's no stranger to life's detours. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to hear the story of Cody Hogan, from his upbringing on a cattle ranch to his training as a classical pianist to his start in food alongside Alice Waters of Chez Panisse. Cody, good morning.
Good morning.
That's quite a bio.
To me, it just seems like one big accident.
But really? So you just stumble from one crazy thing to another?
Yeah, it's just a series of happy accidents, I think, all the way through.
The news right now is that you're hanging up the chef's clothes and heading out into the dining room at Lydia's. What inspired the change?
I wanted to keep it fresh. I've been in the kitchen at Lydia's since we opened almost 19 years ago. That's a long time in the kitchen for anyone, but I love it.
Especially
I love cooking.
A single kitchen.
Yes, in one single kitchen. Almost my entire culinary career has been spent at Lydia's. But I love Lydia and I love her philosophy, and we connect so well that it just seemed like a natural progression to take what I knew in the kitchen out to the guest in the dining room in person and be able to connect like that.
So when you talk at Lydia, you're talking about Lydia Bastianich.
Yes.
How did you meet her?
That was part of the story. When I started cooking in Kansas City, I was at the Classic Cup in Westport. That was 25 years ago or so.
That doesn't exist
anymore.
But
no,
it was quite a staple at the
yes,
time.
And yeah, revolutionary practically. And it closed. And at the time, the executive chef said to me, you know, when you're a cook, if you ever really want to go on vacation, the only time you can do that is really between jobs. And I had volunteered as, when you're beginning to cook, you can either go to culinary school, or if you've already had to pay for graduate school, you decide, maybe I'll just work and learn to cook that way. So I'm
guessing that the second one is your path?
Yes, the second one is my path.
Because it sounded awfully specific.
Yes. I had eaten around in Kansas City, and I had talked to a number of people, and everyone kept saying, oh, you know, you should try the Classic Cup in Westport. It's really small, and you probably have good opportunities there. They do everything from scratch. So I went in, I had dinner, then I wrote a letter to the chef, and he called, and so I came in. I had never been in a kitchen before other than I think my very first job was being a delivery driver for either Domino's or Pizza Hut when I was in college. So that was my culinary experience. It was carrying food in a box and putting it in someone's hands.
And having an aroma in your car.
Yes, exactly. That would never go away. But I took his advice while I was there. Whenever guest chefs would come, usually to the American, because the American restaurant would host James Beard events, and they would bring in all these famous chefs from all over the country. And so as a young cook, you would volunteer a day or 2 days of just helping them prep for their dinner that they're going to be having. And they would say to you, you know, if you're ever in the neighborhood, here's my business card. You can come by and stop at my restaurant. You can hang around for a little bit and learn some things in the kitchen. And I don't know, having been on the other side of that, I don't know that any of those chefs ever actually mean that. They're right. Just being nice. But I had collected a stack of business cards, and a large number of those were on the West Coast. So when the stint ended at the Classic Cup, I decided, you know, I think I'm just going to drive out to California, and I'm going to start in Los Angeles and just work my way north and visit all the chefs that I can on this list or in this stack of cards that I have.
Did you contact them ahead of time, or you just dropped by?
Well, I contacted several of them and didn't hear anything back for some reason. so I just showed up at the door.
But wait, what year is this?
This is 97, I think.
So are you emailing them using,
Oh, no, this was letters right. At that point. I don't know if I was technologically that advanced.
It was the days of all the, like, beeping and blipping on your startup, your, like,
yes.
Those dial-up connections and everything. I don't blame you.
And phone calls and I didn't have a cell phone back then. You know, that was when you would feed quarters into a strange phone somewhere. So I started, the first place I showed up was La Brea Bakery with a really famous baker in Los Angeles. And it's kind of interesting that, you know, you could hang out a day or two with one of these people and they would say, you know, I think you might really enjoy spending time with so-and-so. And they would contact that chef and they would send you to them and you could hang out there for a day or two.
So well, you didn't hear back from a lot of people, but you did hear back from some?
I did. I heard back from one specifically, that was Chez Panisse. But I started at La Brea Bakery just showing up, and they were really, really nice to me. They took me through the whole process and the production of the breads they were making, let me get a little taste of it. And then I continued up the coast, stopping for a stint at Chez Panisse that actually had been organized by Lou Jane Temple, who is a culinary figure here in Kansas City.
And we should, okay, so just in case there are people who don't know what we're talking about. When we say Chez Panisse, that's a really kind of innovative, early on, before people were really popularly talking about using fresh local ingredients and doing innovative things with those and focusing on what's in season and keeping the ingredient list simple, but the ideas creative, like all that stuff. That was Chez Panisse.
Yeah, that really, she was the first person, I think, to put those words together and be able to be heard and spread this message.
Alice Waters.
Yeah, Chef Alice Waters. And it was so revolutionary. And even she will say, you know, when we started this, we had no idea what we were doing. We didn't necessarily know how to cook. We didn't know how to shop. And she also said that was maybe, you know, part of their success is they, you know, they didn't know that you could order from a commercial purveyor. If you actually went to a farm or a farmer or someone's garden, the products that you get are much better. She really changed the scene. And I've been back several times over the past 20 years or 19 years. And it's amazing that the food there is still absolutely pristine and amazing. But the rest of the culinary community has gotten so much better, and which I guess was ultimately her mission, was to bring that now then it just seems like, oh, this is really wonderful food. As opposed to 20 years ago, it was, wow, who knew a strawberry could taste like that? Who knew a salad could be this fresh and this delicious? Which sort of brings me to Lydia. If I finish up my trip up the coast, I left San Francisco. Actually, I went to Seattle just because I wanted to go, and I knew there was a good restaurant there, and I just ate there. But I came back to Kansas City, and I started working at Andre's, Confiserie Suisse, here in town, and I worked in chocolate for about 6 months and got a call from Chez Panisse. And they said, you know, we have an opening in our we have a maternity leave coming up and we have an opening in pastry. Would you like to come back? And so you can't turn down a job at Chez Panisse. So I went back for the maternity leave. I was there about 7 months And I really think that's when so many of the flavors that I reference were formed, because that was the first time I was tasting just the best of all these different products.
You were in Northern California, which I'm guessing that when you're going, visiting farms, sourcing local ingredients, doing that kind of stuff, I'm guessing that that's different, though, in Northern California than in Kansas City.
Yes, because they have, you know, for most of the year, they have the most ideal seasons for so many different ingredients. Whereas here, we're slightly limited, although our farmers have gotten so much better in the past 15 years. They've learned to extend their seasons a little bit and experimented with new varieties of plants. So I think the scene here has changed immeasurably. It's so much better. But when I was coming back from Chez Panisse, because I wanted to be back in the Midwest, close to my family who lives in Arkansas. Chef Dan, my very first chef, said, you know, Lydia Bastianich is opening a restaurant in Kansas City. I think you might be interested. So I wrote Lydia a letter, because writing letters had always seemed to work really well for me. I wrote her a letter, and I thought, well, I'll write, because I wanted to be the pastry chef, I'm going to write dessert menus for four seasons for 4 years. So I wrote 16 different menus and sent them to her, and she really liked the menus. And so she said, why don't you come out to New York? So I went out to New York, and I got there, and she said, you know, I love the way this reads. Why don't you start cooking some of these things for me? And I had just, you know, just sort of dreamed up these ideas of different things. And so then I had to start cooking them and presenting them to her.
All and pastry, all dessert.
This was all dessert. And we really hit it off. And that was when I learned that this whole local sustainable fresh ingredients that wasn't just like the Chez Panisse California way of doing it. That's the Italian and also in many parts of the world. That's the ideal way to eat, and that's the way they practice it, and it's very important to them. Whereas here, I think in this country, we had become a little distanced from the source of our food. Everything was being packaged and frozen and canned, and now that it's come back to it's all fresh.
It has come back to that in terms of what people want, but do you think it's come back to that in terms of how we live day to day, most of us?
Not necessarily. And I think part of that, you know, is a statement about our society in general, in that we try to do so much so fast. It's hard to slow down and live the Italian lifestyle or the California lifestyle.
Well, okay, so I do want you to take us back a little bit to this experience at Chez Panisse, because that is such a, it's like almost a holy destination for people who are really interested in food. And you, it sounds like, I mean, it took a lot of preparation and forethought that you did end up having that stack of business cards and everything. But in some ways, you stumbled into that on a road trip.
Exactly. And I don't know if I, like, I don't even know how intentionally collecting the business cards was, because I'm kind of a sentimental person. It's very hard for me to throw things away. So they would just go into the box that was like chef stuff, food stuff.
And so you ended up there. But what was it like? I mean, this, what, 7-month stint at this place, very early in your food career.
Yeah, I still essentially knew nothing. It was very nice of them to take me back and take me in.
What was it like?
Very intimidating, but it was also so exciting. Everything that, every day was, because the menu, there's a restaurant downstairs and a cafe upstairs, and every day the menu changed. So you would be learning new recipes. And also that restaurant had so many people that had worked there for so many years that had such an amazing collective reference for dishes, and they all had notes, and everyone there loved what they were doing, and they would all keep records, and we would have weekly meetings, and someone would say, well, you know what was really wonderful, and they would pull out their notepad, and that's the way they would construct menus.
So you did this daily changing menu for 7 months and then came back to Kansas City and ended up writing a letter to Lydia Bastianich, hitting it off with her based on your 4 years of, or 4 years of four seasons each of dessert menus?
Yes, just some ideas.
And so, do you remember when you first started working at Lydia's, what what that experience was like, just in the context of Kansas City and the restaurant scene at that time. 1998 was a very different picture, I feel like.
Oh, definitely. And sort of to tie Lydia and Alice Waters into this, you know, I had Lydia saying, you know, this is the Italian way. And when I left Chez Panisse, Alice said, you know, I want you to take, you know, the inspiration you've got here, and I want you to take that back with you to Kansas City in the Midwest. And then I got here, and the first thing I did, I started ordering products from our purveyors, and then I noticed, you know, this apple is really not very interesting. How am I going to do anything delicious with this apple, or how can I make it special? And that's when I started going to the local farmer's market. And I would go every Saturday, and I would I'd get a bunch of cash from the restaurant. And I even went with Lydia once or twice when she was in town. And she taught me how to buy an entire table of produce. She you know, if she saw something that, you know, she always thought in big numbers, like volume for a restaurant. And she would say, we'll take that, and just wave her arm at the table. Or, you know, if she wanted some flowers to put on display at the entryway, she would buy, you know, 2 5-gallon buckets of flowers. Everything she did was really big. And, you know, when she said, when you see something really good, you need to get it, take it back to the restaurant and share it with everyone else. So I would leave the restaurant, and I remember being there once, and Lauren Chapin, who used to be the food critic for The Star, we knew each other, and she saw me driving out, and she took some pictures, I wish I had them now, of me with driving my little white car with produce and boxes and flowers sticking out of every window and the trunk. And but that's what I did for a year or two, was shopping at the restaurant. And at that point, few of these farmers, actually none of them except for Thane Palmberg, who's been there forever, really sold much to restaurants. And they noticed every week that I was coming and I would spend $1,000 or more in our local market. And then I started saying, you know, I could probably buy a lot more from you if you would deliver this to the restaurant. And so that's when people started paying attention and started making it easier. And then Lydia had the idea. She said, why don't you invite all the farmers that you know and get as many of the local chefs as you can to come to the restaurant and see if we can't connect chefs and restaurants. And we just sort of had a little round table. It's like that, whatever the dating thing is, where people switch from person to person and just go around in a circle. And so the farmers and the chefs did that. And everyone talked about what they wanted and, you know, what could they share and what were they looking for. It was really the thing of the city.
So that was in the just late 90s, early 2000s?
Exactly.
That does sound really ahead of that time as far as that farmer-restaurant connection goes. And by then, I mean, do you remember a farmer who especially, I don't know, compelling, who had stuff that just intrigued you and really inspired your creativity?
You know, there's one that sticks out in my mind. Dan May and his wife were really the only word I can think of just to describe him was completely crazy. He would get
He's
excited.
He's a tomato guy, right?
He did. Yes, he did lots of tomatoes. But also, he was the first one that Lydia had introduced me to an Italian seed company. And I would take him to a website or give him a catalog and say, would you try to grow this and this and this and this and this? And he would. And he, you know, he's since moved on. I'm not even sure what he's doing now. But, you know, he was so excited, and it was his enthusiasm was so contagious that you just had to love it.
So is that what you mean when you say that they were crazy, just that their level of enthusiasm?
Yes. And, yeah, there were – well, that and he was just crazy. But he really loved when people were excited about something that he could grow and he could make.
And that inspired your food?
Oh, definitely.
I want to briefly touch on that. As a younger man, you were not even planning on going into food. You were headed toward a career as a classical pianist.
Yes. It started out with me growing up on a ranch. And my grandmother played piano by ear. And she was my very first teacher. But she played by ear, and she didn't read music. And she thought, you know, you really should read music. Out a piano teacher. And I went to undergraduate school in piano in southern Arkansas at a university called Henderson. And then I came to Kansas City to go to the graduate school here at the conservatory. And I had a Rotary scholarship. an ambassadorial scholarship while I was here, and I studied in Germany, in Freiburg, Germany. And while I was there, my Rotary, I guess you would call them parents.
It was like a homestay type thing?
No, I stayed in university housing, which I love because it sort of forces you to work on your language skills. And I'd studied German for about 4 years in undergrad school, so I had a good head start. But they were there if I needed any sort of help, just reach out to them. But they were both retired doctors, and they loved Italy. And more than that, they loved to eat. And they would take me to, if there were any kind of festival. And this was in the southern part of Germany in Freiburg. So it was on the French-German-Swiss border. Any little festival that was food-related, they would say, hey, we're going to Scheibenschlagen or something like that. We would have...
Is that a real place or did you just make that up?
No, that's an event that happens okay. outside of Basel that they do in the wintertime. It's absolutely crazy. It involves slinging glowing coals off of the end of a stick out into the nightlight. It looks like really primitive fireworks, but it usually ends up with... eating schmaltz and really fancy...
Chicken fat?
Yes, exactly, with herbs. Absolutely delicious. Spread on toasted or grilled bread. But we would go to France. We would go over. We would buy wine for the next few months. Then they would take me to one bakery up in Strasbourg that made the most perfect Kugelhopf. You just had to have it from this place. And that was they actually... because they loved Italy so much, I gave a house concert at their house one time, and she put out a buffet, and she had tiramisu on it that she had made. And I was like, what is this? And back then, it was probably, I don't even know if it had been heard of here. But she was like, oh, we learned this in Italy. You'll love it. And it was absolutely delicious. And I didn't even know what it was at the time, and it wasn't until years later that I remembered, oh, that was that dish that we've been serving at Lydia's for the past 19 years.
I love that you kind of got your bigger start in food through pastry, but that as this student who's first getting in touch with what's going to be your future career, you have not even heard of tiramisu.
that's how... far out of it I was. Maybe that's, if I had known or grown up with a lot of those things, I might not have been as excited about it because, when something's new, it always gets your attention more.
But you did grow up on, it was a cattle ranch?
A cattle ranch.
And that seems like it would be connected to food in a pretty important way. I mean, does that background factor into any of the stuff you've done at Lydia's?
It does some. How does it fit into Lydia's?
Or just into your relationship with food, because that many chefs grew up with livestock surrounding them.
Yeah, there was always beef. I'll say that. I think the biggest culinary influence I had growing up would be my grandparents. I think my parents were of the generation where, if you grew up and you were poor and you were on a farm. You wanted to sort of distance yourself from that. So, my parents, thought, the things that came out of the frozen section or the cans, there was something that said more about success if you had those products. My grandparents, however, one of them had an enormous garden. And then my other grandparent had, she had a very small garden. She grew lots of things in old wash tubs, like great tomatoes and things like that. But they cooked everything from scratch. And, when you're very small, a very easy way to babysit is to put your grandchild up on the counter next to you and put them to work doing something. They can peel things or they can stir a bowl of fudge or, whatever. And that just made it very comfortable for me to be with food.
You're leaving that proximity to the food itself even while you're staying within the restaurant. So, how do you think your relationship with food is going to change as you move from the kitchen into the dining room?
I don't know that it's going to change that much, or at least at this point it hasn't, because I still, if I see something on a plate that, just like when I was a chef, if I think, I don't know that I approve of this, I can go right back to the cook that prepared this and say, I think maybe you missed on this one. So I'm still connected that way. I'm certainly not afraid to get back there and teach things. I've been making this Lydia's food for all this time, and I'm glad to share that with any of the cooks that come in.
Explain what a general manager does, or in the parlance of a kitchen, the GM.
I think that I don't know if there's any title that is more appropriate for what a general manager does than generally managing things. That's exactly what it is. You deal with all the physical issues of a building, an aging or 150-year-old restaurant building that we're in, the Freight House. You deal with all the customers. You deal with all the cooks. You deal with getting the front of the house staff, the servers, to communicate well with the back of the house. Sometimes there's a little bit of a divide between those two.
What kind of divide?
You know, the front of the house, the service staff, they're trying to make the guests happy. And the cooks in the back of the house are trying to make the dish that they know and that they like to make and that they're prepared to make. But sometimes the guest in the front of the house wants something a little different. So they ask the server and the server asks the cook. And they're back and forth. There can be a little animosity there.
So do you think that your experience is going to help you bridge that?
I think that I've already noticed that it's made a difference. And I also,
how have you noticed that? I mean, how long have you been? You've already made the switch.
Yes, 5 weeks ago. So right now I'm still learning the nuts and bolts of the front of the house. I've never worked in the front of the house other than being a cater waiter one summer. But the servers can come to me just because I know what the kitchen can do. And, you know, how reasonable or unreasonable a request is. And I think that's made things easier. And I can also go back into the kitchen and I have the vocabulary to explain to the cooks what we need or what the guest is asking. And that's really, you know, when you're managing the front of the house, it's all about hospitality and making the guest happy. And it's not just about feeding them. You know, generally when people go out to a restaurant, yes, they're hungry, but they're looking for more than that. They want to be taken care of. They've had a bad day at work, or the kids are driving them crazy. How can I help that person at that time?
How can you help that person at that time? Because that seems maybe outside the scope of a general manager of the restaurant.
Well, that's part of managing the service aspect and the hospitality of the restaurant. And, you know, part of it is just understanding it's not just about me. And this is something that I deal with the service staff. It's not just about them. Don't forget, ultimately, those tips affect your income, but it's also about making the guest happy. And if you get those two things together, then everyone is better off.
If we would go back to your music background, do you think that the general manager is kind of like the composer bringing up the different sections of the restaurant orchestra, like atmosphere, kitchen?
I don't know if I would say composer. I would say conductor. It's more conducting.
Right. That's what I meant. Oh, that's what Sorry. You
mean. Okay. But yeah, it's you know, getting the lights right, getting the everything. It all fits together.
Cody Hogan, best of luck in your new role.
Thank you very much.
Cody Hogan is moving from chef de cuisine to general manager at Lydia's in the Crossroads. Up next, the story of a Kansas History Museum crammed inside a two-bedroom New York City apartment. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned to KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and our next guest is with us from New York City, where she took all of the items from her childhood home in Kansas that she inherited when her father passed away. She did not do the standard thing of keeping a few treasured objects and getting rid of the rest. Instead, she went against those minimalist mantras of our times and crammed as much of her family's past as she could into a two-bedroom apartment in Greenwich Village, where she now lives among the relics. Susie Chase, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being with us. First of all, tell me about your family and the home you grew up in.
Well, I grew up with my mom in Prairie Village, and she was a big antiques buff. And my family on both sides is very old. Both of the sides are predate the Mayflower. So we always had a lot of family heirlooms. And then
like
when my mom died, I have a Battle of Gettysburg sword that my great-great-great-grandfather captured.
And you just grew up with that around?
Yes. And it was just normal to me. I didn't realize it was so interesting. It was just my house.
And this was in Prairie Village?
Yeah, in Prairie Village. Isn't that funny?
Yeah. But go on. Okay, so you grew up with all this stuff, and your family, you have kind of a famous family.
Yes. Well, on my dad's side, it's the Chases, which includes Sam and Pete Chase, who was the 6th Chief Justice of the United States and 25th Secretary of Treasury, Samuel Chase, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, Jonathan Chase, another ancestor, was a colonel in the Revolutionary War. As I said, my great-great-great-grandfather fought in the Battle of Gettysburg. And then I have my great-grandfather and his father together fought in the Civil War. So I have their pocket revolver framed, which is really neat.
When did you move to New York?
I moved to New York in 1996. I left my jobs at, do you remember Light 99.7?
I do.
It was... I left my jobs at Light 99.7 and Pig Out Publications to move to New York City to do national cookbook publicity in Soho.
When was this?
96.
And how old were you?
I was 28.
So how did your family respond to your plans to move? It sounds like on both sides, your family was so entrenched in this very specific place with all these heirlooms surrounding them. You know what I mean?
You're right. My dad had never really been to New York City, so he just thought it was a scary, dangerous place. My mom was always the type who always wanted to spread her wings and fly. So she said, do it. This is your opportunity. Go and fly.
Tell me about the life you established there.
So I moved to the West Village, which, as you said, is in Greenwich Village. It's darling. There are cobblestone streets, short buildings, nothing. There aren't any skyscrapers. And I just felt I'd never been there before. And I fell in love with it. And it felt so normal. So I started my life here. My husband... Fast forward, I met my husband and we have a little boy and we raise him in the West Village, which is darling.
So this is a 2-bedroom apartment you're living in and you have this home. It sounds like 2 family homes on your mom's side and your dad's side. Like it sounds as though they were perhaps
yes.
Not married.
Yeah, they were divorced, but my mom... My dad basically just moved out, so my mom had everything.
And so tell me about what was going on when you inherited all this stuff. Usually, unfortunately, an inheritance like this is tinged with loss.
I know. And, you know, since you contacted me, I've really been thinking about the connection between objects and memories. And with every object I have, there's a memory to it, but it's all good. And to me, it is so comforting and homey.
So what happened? I mean, I'm guessing somebody died.
Yeah. Yes. Well, it's a bit of a tragic tale. So in the past 16 years, all of my immediate family members have died. My 3 brothers, my mom and dad and my stepmother.
That is a
lot.
It's
been overwhelming. But to come home to this, my home that I had when I was little, is so comforting.
So you have in some ways recreated that home in your New York City apartment.
Yes.
But the scale of how much stuff you inherited from this estate, as compared to the size of a New York City apartment, seems almost impossible to manage.
Right. Well, we have a storage unit in Kansas City. So we brought everything we could to fit in our 900-square-foot apartment.
Why do you think you made that choice? Because the trend right now, and also just I think a lot of people are overwhelmed by stuff, like what am I going to do with all this stuff? And
I did, because, you know, we're all IKEA and Target and minimalism is, but I feel like this is a different kind of minimalism, you know?
No, I don't. What do you mean by that?
Really? Because, like, it's, well, first of all, it has to be minimalism, minimalistic, because we have a 900 square foot apartment. But I didn't go out and buy any of this. So this all just came to me in kind of a minimalistic sort of mind frame.
So what you did is, if I understand correctly, from you've been highlighted in decor blogs and things like that, it sounds like you got rid of a lot of the sort of functional stuff in your own apartment and used every little bit of wall space or every little bit of floor space that you could to put a relic from your Kansas past in your space and to live with it.
Yes. Yeah. And frankly, I think it's so much cuter than IKEA stuff. Like, for example, we have a couch that my mom got in 1983, and she slip covered it in this plaid. Well, the fabric is wearing away, so I keep having my seamstress cover it with denim. So it's kind of patchy, and you can tell it definitely has memories and it definitely has a story.
What do you think it is that has the decor world intrigued? Because decor does not seem to be what's motivating you. This seems to be motivated by an emotional connection to your past and to a lot of people who you've lost.
I know. That's why I found it so interesting that people were in my little corner of the world. It's everything I know.
Susie Chase, stay with me, okay?
Yeah.
We are going to finish this conversation with Susie Chase about her New York City memorial to Kansas history when we return. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Susie Chase, who is living in New York now. She grew up in Prairie Village and she has inherited her family's estate, and she has put as much of it as possible into her two-bedroom, 900-square-foot New York City apartment. Susie, welcome back.
Thank you.
So tell me about, first of all, about this moment in your life when you've experienced so much loss. Take us to that moment with you a little bit so that we understand what it was you were feeling when you got all this stuff.
Well, it's totally surreal not to have any immediate family members at a young age. So young-ish. So I feel like my home is an extension of them. I feel like they're always with me here in my home.
Can you tell me about one of your favorite things that connects you to a particular person?
Well, definitely my mom. We have two wingback chairs that she had slip covered with this toile fabric that has since been discontinued. And I remember sitting in those chairs when I was pregnant with my little boy, and we would just talk and sit in those chairs. So that's a really nice memory.
Do you ever, I mean, do people visit your house and go through it like a museum?
Yeah, lots of my friends say it feels like their 80-year-old grandmother's home, which is kind of funny. But yes, I'm always interested in the people who say, what's that? Okay, what's that? What's that? So that's always fun explaining things.
What are some of the items that get the most curiosity from visitors?
I definitely think the sword, my silver. I have a set of silver from, the Chase side, and maybe our family Bible that's all tattered and really, really old.
Tell me more about the tattered old family Bible. I've heard that this is the only object that people aren't allowed to touch.
Yes. So, interestingly enough, for the piece on that website, 6 Square Feet, the photographers James and Carla Murray, who are amazing New York City photographers, they noticed it and they said, I said, yeah, I need to have it rebound. And they said, well, we know this, the last guy in New York City who binds books. So they're going to document with photographs rebinding of my Bible this summer. So I'm really, really excited about that.
How old is this Bible?
Oh, God, it goes back to 17 somethings. I'm really afraid to touch it.
It's going back to this idea that a lot of people can probably relate to the experience of you've lost someone and that comes with a lot of stuff. And there's a combination of logistics and emotion that you respond with. You've got the what will I do with this stuff? And then you've got your heart pulling you toward one thing or another. And it sounds like you just embraced both sides of it. A lot of people feel torn between, I'm emotionally connected with this thing, but I don't know what to do with it. How did you figure out what to do with it? What was your approach?
Luckily, everything that I really, really love that was in storage, we were able to fit in this apartment. Thank goodness. But I mean, for example, my mom gave my little boy her piano that she got in 1930 something, and that's still in storage. So that one's a toughie.
The fact that it's still in storage and not right there in your apartment?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What would you say to someone who goes through their stuff periodically and purges just unsentimentally? The idea that a piano purchased in the 1930s is something that means so much that your son now has it. It seems like if someone had been purging frequently back at that time and had not been attached to stuff, and if it hadn't been passed through previous generations, that you wouldn't have this. But we all feel so burdened by stuff.
Well, I think in terms of purging and or not purging, I think I come by it rightly. My family has saved things, which I'm so very happy about, through generation to generation to generation. So I kind of have that bug too. But on the other hand, I'm kind of envious of people who can just say, oh, I just threw out that dining room table because I was sick of it. I kind of wish I had a little bit of that, too, that it doesn't really mean that much.
So you're saying people come over to friends will come over. Do other people other than friends come over to take a tour of this stuff? I mean, the relatives that you've talked about, people, you had a signer of the Declaration of Independence in your family. There's relevance outside your family for some of this stuff.
Yeah. Well, I don't really host tours in our West Village apartment, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah, I mean, if people
maybe I should.
Because it sounds almost like a museum of Kansas history.
It kind of is. And another thing is one of my mother's cousins did some of the murals in the Kansas State Capitol. So we have some of his things on the wall, too, which is exciting. His name was David Overmeyer.
Tell us about something that you have on the wall by him and what we might learn about Kansas from it.
Well, he did the covers for this house. I believe it was called Housekeeping Magazine back in the 50s. So I have a couple of those magazines that he did. It's hard because his stuff has never gone to auction, so it's not out there. I'd love to buy one of his pieces. And I just got back taking my 10-year-old to Kansas for spring break, and we went to the Capitol, and he saw the murals, which are stunning.
Does it ever feel sort of out of place for you? You talked about that you feel when you come back to your apartment like you're going home, like you're going to that childhood place. But Prairie Village and Greenwich Village are so different. And the scale of things is so different, just that it used to all be sort of spread out in a house, and now it's crammed together in an apartment. Does it ever feel like you're in kind of a weird dream?
Yeah, it does. But on the other hand, I love it. And it's interesting because we live in the West Village and it's super small, and I call it Mayberry. Everyone knows each other. It really reminds me of Prairie Village. I used to hang out in Prairie Village Shopping Center. I knew all the shop people, just like my little boy knows all the shop people in the West Village here. So they're similar in certain aspects.
So from one village to another?
Yes, exactly.
But you are not known for being a historian. You're not known for being a decor person, even though your apartment's been highlighted. You're known for being a podcaster.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell me about your background in that realm?
I have two podcasts. I have the oldest soul music podcast called thegrooveradio.com, and I DJ here in New York City. A lot of my sets on The Groove Radio were recorded at Trophy Bar in Brooklyn. And my other podcast is Cookery by the Book, and it's the only cookbook podcast. So I interview cookbook authors, and it's a lot of fun.
When you took on what is essentially like an archivist's meets decor person's project, did you feel out of your element at all?
In terms of decorating?
Yeah, in terms of taking all of these incredibly old, and I'm guessing fragile, delicate things that need to be handled in certain ways. I've worked in museums, and the stuff you're talking about, I don't know. It's when you're working in radio or in podcasts, you're dealing with everything is intangible. And then suddenly you're handling all these objects and trying to incorporate them into your home.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think I would rather take the risk of something being broken, having it out and displayed. You know, it kind of makes me sad when people have all of their china put away because they don't want to break it. But I love it being used every day and seen and sat on and touched. Not touched every day, but, you know, out and about.
Is there something that you think people would be just shocked to discover you use on a day-to-day basis?
Oh, my gosh. That's a good one. No, it's more decorative than anything else. It's more things hanging and furniture and such.
I am guessing that, you know, even though this Civil War sword is something that catches everyone's attention, there's something in your home that you notice that not a lot of other people do. Can you tell us about your favorite thing like that?
Well, I have, well, there's a painting that my mom had done of me when I was 2. So I think I love that more than anything else.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing that story with us, and enjoy all of those Kansas things. You'll have to send us some pictures so that we can share them with our listeners.
Thank you so much. You're welcome anytime.
Our time is up. Susie Chase has been talking with us from New York City. Her podcasts are Cookery by the Book and The Groove Radio. And she's been telling us about her Kansas shrine there in the West Village. Tomorrow, we will be talking with the KU professor who says he quit over concealed carry in the classroom. Hear his story tomorrow at 10. You can listen to anything you've heard on KCUR Central Standard at kcur.org/Central Standard, where we make all of our conversations available to you online. And that's a wrap for today's show. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tedhope, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date with Steve Kraske. That's coming up next.